Fascism. It's the song I hate. It's the song I hate. It is Fuck Off Fascism Week here on The Wire. Every day this week we'll be talking to academics, activists and other insightful voices about the concept of fascism and its return to the global political conversation. Today, producer Ben Goldson joins us to look at the ideology of fascism, its historical roots and what constitutes fascism today. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
How are you going?
You can hear me? Yeah, good. Been doing good. Bit of a cold, but sort of pulled through.
Great. Glad to hear it. So, what's happening with fascism today on The Wire?
Well, I think probably it's good just to look at where the word itself comes from. It's got pretty simple origins from an ancient Roman symbol of authority that was then adopted by radical political groups, including Benito Mussolini's Fasci of Revolutionary Action, which was created during the First World War. So Mussolini would then take power in 1922 after the March on Rome, and after that, fascism would then be established as a general term for similar movements in different countries. Of course, these leaders, such as Hitler, were inspired by Mussolini, but their fascisms reflected their country's own particular history, so they had specific little differences. But what united them ultimately was a shared belief in sort of seeing human existence as just a constant struggle for survival, in which the nation had a destiny which was threatened by its many enemies. Now, in practice, of course, this led to authoritarian dictatorship, world war, and genocide, which is the fascism we're all very familiar with. But, of course, at some point, these were just theories. And so for more on these theories, I speak with history professor Marja Abendhuis from the University of Auckland. And so I started by asking her just what the various precursors to fascism were.
Bombastic Mussolini, the sawdust Caesar, comes to his end in the gutter. Fitting climax to a life of treachery and double cross.
Fascism is clearly a product of the First World War, and without the First World War we can't really understand it. It would never have come about, certainly not in the way it did. But obviously it has lots of precursors in the 19th century world, particularly in the 19th century European world. I think the most important of those are connected to a rising nationalism and a sense that people really did believe that their community, the people in their nation, and they considered it often on racial and ethnic basis, were organically connected and had a sense of unity to it, so that they could, if they the positive vision of this nationalism was, if they really made the most of that, then they could conquer the world and conquer other lesser peoples as well, and they would have the right to do that. So the second thing that really influenced the rise of fascism was the idea of some people call it social Darwinism, the right of certain groups, stronger groups, to rule weaker groups of people. And they based that on Darwin's theories of evolution, that in nature the strong outlast the weak and the stronger traits win out in the end, so that and they translated that into sort of human society. So stronger groups of human beings have the right to conquer those who are not as capable of looking after themselves and combining their resources and so forth. So those were two of the main developments that helped to bring an idea of fascism about. But there were also different versions of that tried before World War One. Artists, cultural movements, political movements that challenged the existing way things were done, and who really thought that by creating highly disciplined, militarized societies that had careful state control over economic relations, that they would improve the lot of the people in that nation. So they looked at it as a positive force to really improve the country and the nation they were in.
And how widespread were these beliefs before the First World War?
Well, all of them existed in a variety of forms, in particularly in the European world. But it really did take that First World War and the scale of death and destruction and militarization of society to make it have widespread appeal, as in fascism became a movement that began in Italy in the war as a counter to the experience of war. Not so much a counter as a way of saying, well, we're going to, if you take this idea, we're going to create a stronger Italy, and we're going to build an Italian nation that can become an Italian empire again. People will be disciplined again. People will have the economy working for each and every one of them. But it requires the individual to sacrifice themselves for the good of the all. That was the idea. And we can't imagine that without that catastrophe that was the First World War. So while there were all these things and various strands of it, nationalism, militarism, critiques of liberal democracy, and the notion that totalitarianism might be a better way. Well, we see strands of that before the First World War. It required that experience to turn it into political movements that then have a chance of gaining control in Italy and then in Germany and Hungary and so forth.
I mean, carrying on from that, what were the differences, some of the differences between these different national movements?
Well, that's a good question, because there were quite substantial differences. The Italian fascist movement was highly focused on one man, Benito Mussolini, of course, but it was clearly Italian. So it was, whereas the German Nazi movement was much more, well, it was clearly Germanic, so that this is the national differences, but the Nazi movement was much more racially defined, and it spent much more energy on identifying who was a German and so who fit into the German Empire and the German Reich and who did not. And they defined that very clearly along racial lines and on ideological lines as well. And they'd cast Jewish people with Jewish heritage, as being not German and being racially different from a German, whereas, of course, Judaism is a religion and it is not a race. But at the time, it was cast as a race by the Germans. So while the Italian fascists also excluded others and had clear racial differentiations between Italians and non-Italians in terms of being from European or in New Zealand we'd say Pākehā background and not, they weren't as, and they certainly took care of any ideological opponents and policed them very carefully and very strictly. They weren't as rigid along this who belonged in that empire as the Germans were. But this notion of nation, meaning a people who was clearly defined, was common to them all. And they certainly also believed very strongly in the notion of blood and soil, so that to be a member of the nation, one needed to be living in the defined empire for which the Italians or the Germans fought for. It was their land that they worked, and it's their land that they fought for, shed their blood for. So there are common strands, certainly have totalitarian models, certainly at the notion that each person in the regime had to sacrifice their own self for the collective well-being, which was defined by the party, but certainly by the person who ran the regime at the top, so Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini in these cases. Oh, it's the fascinating thing about fascism was that it ended It ended in the way that it existed in that interwar period. I think it's very much a clearly defined political response to a really difficult international situation where countries were challenged by all sorts of issues, the First World War, the Great Depression, and people were looking for ways of solving these fundamental issues they were facing, and then but they were willing to risk war and go to war to achieve these idealized dreams, these sort of utopic notions of exclusionary politics, which were hugely violent and restrictive. But the Second World War did demolish many of the foundations of those fascist regimes. I mean, it ended two of them, and while there were still fascist were still regimes in the aftermath of the Second World War that had remnants of that kind of ideology in them, Franco-Spain, for example. They were not the same thing, I think. So I think it was a movement of the moment, a movement attached to that 1914-1945 catastrophic period of world history, I think.
After World War II, openly fascist groups were consigned to the fringes of politics. The term itself became a widely used insult, which raises a question. Can the concept of fascism be applied to groups which do not identify as such, even in private? The recent rise of nationalist leaders throughout the world has made this question more relevant than ever. Most famous of these is undoubtedly the current American president, Donald Trump. His rise reflected the failures of the last Republican president, George Bush Jr., whose final approval ratings were comparable to Richard Nixon. Bush left office during a crash in the value of subprime mortgage bonds, which eventually wiped $15 trillion out of existence. Facing a total collapse of the financial system, Bush approved billions of dollars in taxpayer-funded bailouts. However, since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, the Republican Party had been virtually unanimous in their opposition to this exact type of government interference. Reagan had claimed the wealth created by his economic reforms would trickle down to all of society, although in practice this had failed to happen. Reagan was strongly influenced by a movement which called itself the New Right, who had sought to draw a line between what was respectable conservatism and what wasn't. Despite their efforts, this line was somewhat superficial, as what truly divided them was the degree to which the many threats to America formed a single conspiracy. Moderate conservatives simply claimed the liberals who ran the federal government were too weak in the face of, say, godless communism or violent crime. In contrast, extremists, such as the John Birch Society, claimed these groups were all part of the same conspiracy, which sought to create anarchy and eventually a world government. What the New Right did was present these beliefs in a way which retained the raw appeal of radicalism, but was acceptable for widespread consumption. When these beliefs were challenged, most notably in 2008, mainstream conservatives were faced with two choices. They could renounce their beliefs in an economic policy which had done almost exactly the opposite of what it had promised, or they could refuse to admit defeat, which meant reverting to the inherent extremist theories upon which the New Right had been based. Republican ideology had not failed, it had been betrayed by establishment politicians, who lacked ideological purity. This process of radicalization took place outside of the immediate control of the party, in the network of privately owned groups directly controlled by their donors. For example, the premier conservative media outlet, Fox News, gave significant airtime to Glenn Beck, who accused President Obama of being a socialist. This was very similar to accusations made by the John Birch Society against Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, which had led to their isolation in the 1950s. In the late 2000s, on the other hand, Beck's allegations made him one of the key figures in the emerging Tea Party. The Tea Party received financial support from a variety of sources, most famously the billionaire Koch brothers. The sons of a founding member of the John Birch Society, they poured millions of dollars into the radical Tea Party. With the line between radical extremism and mainstream conservatism now virtually indistinguishable, the Tea Party began to clash with the Republican establishment. While Republican voters settled for the moderate Mitt Romney in 2012, this was only after a series of more extreme candidates had briefly emerged as frontrunners. Romney lost, of course, which sentenced Republicans to another 4 years of Obama. By 2016, they deserted candidates perceived as establishment, such as Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. Instead, they turned to candidates whose principles were more in line with where their beliefs were, such as Ted Cruz or the eventual nominee, celebrity billionaire Donald Trump. So, does Trump represent an American fascism? When comparing Trump to, say, Hitler, it is important to remember that Hitler did not campaign on a platform of world war or genocide. These were instead achieved through several years of gradualism, such as the suppression of dissent, the creation of racially segregated ghettos, and a foreign policy which promised to put Germany first.
A new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions. It's time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers will never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. Together, we will make America great again.
In contrast, President Trump has dropped several of his more extreme policies as a candidate, such as a pledge to imprison his rival, Hillary Clinton. This does not mean his presidency is not part of the process towards an American fascism, but he is most likely not its final stage. This process predates Trump, of course, and so will continue after he leaves office. Will Republican voters simply return to the moderates Trump railed against during the primary, or will they be attracted to even more radical politicians?
Yeah. Fuck off fascism.